You are listening to the podcast of the Matyas Corvinus Collegium, the largest talent management institute in Hungary. If you want to know more about our mission, please look up our English website at mcc.hu/en or check out our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter channels for interesting articles and analysis of our professors, external contributors, and students. Look up our knowledge base at corvinak.hu/en.
A very warm welcome to those listening to our podcast. My name is Ferenc Sullivan from the Youth Research Institute at MCC. I'm a research fellow, and my guest this afternoon is Dr. Anthony Daniels, better known perhaps by the pen name Theodore Dalrymple, who has worked for decades as a psychiatrist, and his work has taken him to a large number of very exotic corners of our world, including Kiribati, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Tanzania, just to name a few. So he is a man of exceptionally broad outlook and experience of our cultures and the values those cultures hold dear or not so dear. And these are going to be the subject of our conversation today. Dr. Daniels, thank you for accepting our invitation.
Thank you for inviting me.
In a recent talk delivered a couple of years ago, you make the claim that societies don't break. They continue to exist even after a catastrophe, although often in an unpleasant way. Could you elaborate on that? Is our society broken?
Well, of course, all these questions depend on definitions. So one can say of my own society that I think that certain of its developments are very unpleasant. And you can see this in other societies as well. Broken by broken, if you mean, is it not going to continue to exist? Of course, it's going to continue to exist. So in a sense, it doesn't just break into pieces like a cup or a plate if dropped. It just develops in a different way. But certainly, certain things that one took for granted, one can no longer take for granted.
You have described contemporary Britain as a moral swamp in one of your many books. And you have called for the rebirth of traditional British values, which in your opinion include prudence, thrift, industry, honesty, moderation, politeness, and self-restraint.
Yes, well, what has happened has been a kind of gestalt switch as to what is desirable. So that, for example, the idea of self-control has been replaced completely by the value of self-expression, irrespective of what it is that has to be expressed and whether it is worth expressing. And that means that there is no restraint in public. And I'm talking particularly in terms of public behavior. I'm actually quite liberal, but I want there to be decorum in public. What goes on in private is of less importance to me, provided it doesn't have public effects. And I can give you lots of examples if you want it.
In economics, we tend to talk about the trickle-down effect.
Yes.
You have decades of experience as a psychiatrist working in the prison system and with deprived communities in the East End of London, for example. Yeah. Have you felt the opposite happening? Moral standards and habits cultivated by the lower social strata somehow infiltrating
and
trickling up.
Yes, well, I think that is certainly the case. And if you a very interesting example is the difference between Mrs. Thatcher and Mr. Blair in the way that they spoke. Mrs. Thatcher was actually of much humbler origin than Mr. Blair, but she learned to speak in what one might call an upper class or upper middle class way, whereas Mr. Blair, who was actually upper middle class, tried to speak as if he were of lower social class. So that what one person wanted to appear of higher social class than that into which she was born, and the other wanted to appear in a lower social class than that in which he was born. And there are many, many examples. If you look at the way people dress, increasingly they dress as if they were impoverished. They want to appear as if they've emerged from the ghetto in an American city, and yet they are well off. Their speech is vulgar. In fact, everything has become extremely vulgar. There's no idea of imitating those of higher cultural level. On the contrary, the imitation goes in the other direction.
You've written a volume entitled Spoiled Rotten, The Toxic Cult of Sentimentality, published in 2010. And in this, you argue that sentimentality permeates and erodes our culture. Can you please explain how you mean that and how this contributes to, for example, the degeneration of language?
Well, yeah.
Destruction of social norms.
Yes. First of all, it elevates feeling over thought and self-control. And I give at the beginning of that book, if I remember rightly, it's some time since I wrote it, but at the beginning I was impelled to write the book by a story in the newspaper. I can't remember which newspaper, it might have been the local newspaper, about a man who was suing a supermarket because a chicken that it had sold had feet. And, I remember when chickens used to have feet, but anyway, the child of this man was so appalled by seeing the feet of the chicken that he said he had to throw the chicken out of the window. He couldn't use this chicken because his child, who was about 8 years old, I think, burst into tears at the sight of the feet. Now, this seemed to me extraordinary that a grown man should allow his behavior to be controlled or stimulated by an eight-year-old girl having kind of hysterical outburst at the sight of a chicken's foot. And you can see the sentimentality in more than one way. In our language, the word pupil has almost been eliminated for student. Now, at one time, a student was a person who had reached a certain stage in his education. You start out as a pupil, and you gradually grow into being a student. But now you're a student from the age of three, and the authority is actually with the child, in the expression child-centered learning. I don't know whether that exists in Hungarian, but child-centered learning, it means that the child becomes, if you like, the authority in his own education. And that is only appropriate to a later stage in education.
I introduced you as a psychiatrist, but you have contributed to public discourse for several decades. Your first article appeared in the Spectator magazine in 1983, and since then you've been published in a variety of leading international news outlets, most notably The Telegraph. And my question is, so having been part of the discourse for so long, have you noticed that it's talking about morality or the judgment of actions from a moral standpoint in that period has lost legitimacy?
Well, certainly I think the term non-judgmental has come into use since I started, and the idea that it is virtuous to make no judgment, either good or for good or for bad, about someone else's behavior or his tastes or his culture. And of course, it's a completely false, it's in essence a lie. First of all, it's self-congratulatory. If someone says, I'm non-judgmental, what he actually should say is, I'm not censorious, which means the difference between censoriousness and being judgmental has been lost. I mean, you have to make a judgment practically every minute of your day, either aesthetic or moral. But not being censorious means not rushing to too harsh a judgment, which is a good thing. One should not be censorious. But to deny that one is making a judgment is both false and dangerous, because, of course, people who claim to be non-judgmental are, in fact, often making judgments.
Book of yours published in Hungarian is entitled On the Necessity or Usefulness of Stereotypes or Preconceptions, somewhat provocatively. How, in your opinion, do stereotypes contribute to one's ability to lead a morally correct, virtuous life?
Well, I don't know about virtuous life, but it's certainly in practice, it's absolutely necessary. If you're walking, perhaps you don't have this problem in Hungary, and I hope you don't, but if you're walking down a dark street at night and you see an old lady coming towards you, perhaps using a walking stick, you don't think she might be criminally minded. Whereas if you see a young man with a baseball cap pointed backwards, who has a kind of vulpine, wolf-like lope, and has a certain way, a manner of being, it does cross your mind that he might be criminally inclined. Now, both these things are stereotypes. I mean, it is a stereotype that old ladies do not, on the whole, attack men in the street and rob them. That is a stereotype. The thing that is wrong about stereotypes is not that you have them, because everyone has them. You can't avoid having them. If you make any generalization about people, it's based upon a stereotype. What is wrong is not being able to alter your judgment in the light of actual experience. So let me give you an example. I have been very prejudiced in my mind, I don't think it comes out in my behavior, against tattooed people. I dislike tattooing. I was one of the first, I think, to notice that it was ascending the social scale. It used to be something that either criminals or perhaps people in the armed forces would do, but not generally in middle classes. Well, I noticed that it was ascending the scale. Anyway, I was very, very prejudiced against it. And in the prison in which I worked, there was a very, very large man who was covered in tattoos. He was a prison officer. He wasn't a prisoner. He was a prison officer. And these kind of tattoos, I dislike intensely. And I normally associate them in my mind with someone who's violent, aggressive, and so on. But this man, as it happened, although he was very large, shrank away from any kind of violence and was an extremely nice man. So I had to overcome, in his case, my prejudice against tattoos. And if you are aware of your own prejudices, you can overcome them as is necessary in individual cases. But if you try and say, I will have no prejudices at all, then you, I would say life like that would be impossible.
We often talk about the difference in societal values and outlook and historical experience between the two sides of what used to be the Iron Curtain. Now, as I hinted to, you're a very widely traveled gentleman who's been to a host of exotic countries, including North Korea.
Yes.
And of course, some other extremes to the modern Anglo-Saxon world. You've traveled Eastern Europe on the eve of communism. You've been to Romania, you've been to Albania, and you've visited Hungary multiple times, too, the first time being 1970, almost 5 decades ago. What comes to your mind first as to how has the first impression one gets of Hungary and the general disposition or way of life of Hungarians has changed over that time?
Well, of course, when I first came to Hungary, which was in 1970, which I point out is actually more than 5 decades ago, we are now in 2022, so that's 52 years ago. But anyway, I came from Czechoslovakia, and Czechoslovakia, that was only 2 years after the 1968, after the Russian tanks. And Czechoslovakia was markedly worse than Hungary. So Hungary at that time, for example, it was possible to eat in a restaurant, I think, without any special difficulty, which was not possible in Czechoslovakia. And it was a markedly more relaxed society than Czechoslovakia was. If I had come directly to Hungary rather than going via Czechoslovakia, no doubt I would have thought of it as much worse than I did actually think of it. Of course, there were shortages. It was grey. It was very grey. There was not much in the way of, there were not much in the way of consumer goods. And I think I mentioned to you that when I left Hungary, I had to spend a certain number of forints that one was obliged to change into the Hungarian currency. And for the first time in my life, I experienced difficulty in spending money. And so at the end of my period, I had this money which I couldn't spend. And I couldn't find any way to spend it before I left, other than buying either the complete works of Balzac in Hungarian, which would be of limited use to me, or a very large bunch of flowers for the lady in whose flat I stayed. And I bought her this enormous bunch of flowers, and she couldn't understand why I had done it, and I couldn't explain because we didn't have any language in common. So she thought this was very peculiar, since she wasn't particularly friendly to me. As I said, of the communist countries, Hungary was actually the least grey that I came across.
Well, over that time, we have gone from being what was described as probably the most westernized country in the communist bloc to something of an outlier within the Western bloc or within the European Union when it comes to issues such as political correctness, such as woke ideology, such as protection of the traditional family. What is your take on that? how have the efforts of the Hungarian government to preserve what we think of as traditional Western values and accomplishments of Western civilization, how have these gone down in political discourse elsewhere? How have they resonated, and what are the perspectives?
Yeah. Well, first of all, of course, I'm not in a position to either to criticize or to praise in any great detail, since my awareness of the detail of the Hungarian situation is not very great, and I mistrust a great deal of the commentary that that we have in the West, because if you read most of the commentary in the West, it says that Hungary is a highly authoritarian country where there's no freedom of expression and so on and so forth. And in fact, just before I came here, my brother-in-law, my French brother-in-law, said of Hungary that there's no freedom of expression and the press is very much controlled, rather like in any dictatorship. Well, I'm, of course, not in a strong position to refute that because I don't speak Hungarian. But then, of course, neither does my brother-in-law. So he accepts just what he's told. As far as immigration was concerned, I think that the Hungarians can see the problems it's brought to countries like Sweden and Denmark and, of course, Britain and France. And I can well understand why any government would not wish to import those problems into its own country. And I believe that that is the opinion of most Hungarians, because it would be the opinion of most people in Sweden, so for example, or Denmark. So I can well understand that. And it seems to me that a lot of criticism of Hungary is precisely because Hungary is going against a kind of orthodoxy. It's not because it's not criticized because people care very much about whether Hungarians are free to express themselves. I don't think people could care less whether Hungarians are free to express themselves. What they don't like is an example of a country that is doing something different from the social democratic orthodoxy. Just as, for example, the attempts, well, I think they'll be successful, to restore buildings in Budapest and try and restore the city back to what it was before the war. Admittedly, by copying what was there before, it's inevitably copying, will meet with criticisms from architects and architectural critics, because they do not want anyone to believe that the modernist way of building is inevitable. You can't avoid it. There's nothing else you can do. So there's no point in criticizing it, however ugly it has made the world. And it's made the world incredibly ugly, almost everywhere. In Britain, every town and city has been ruined by this modernism. But if you criticize it, they say, oh, well, there's nothing we can do about it. It's the only possible way to build. So what is being done in Budapest is very important, because it's an example that it is not inevitable. And that's why what is being done would be hated.
Well, your critics have labeled you a pessimist.
Yes.
My question is whether you accept that, or whether you...
Yes, I would accept that. I would accept it as praise rather than criticism. I haven't really met many optimists with the sense of humor.
so in light of your pessimism, how would you describe your take on the future of the Hungarian experiment, with special regard to, for example, the efforts to preserve the institution and strengthen the institution of marriage.
Yes.
Which, I mean, your writing is centered upon this, in my point of view, that you see the collapse of traditional families and traditional marriage as one of the main drivers of criminality in impoverished communities in particular.
Yes.
And Hungary has been very bold in countering this this trend and reversing its effects with considerable efficiency and impact.
Yes. Well, when I say I'm a pessimist, what I really mean is that I don't believe that life is perfectible. So I don't expect that once something gets better, then everything will be all right. That is not my view. I think things can be improved, but I don't expect life ever to be nothing but an extremely happy experience for everyone. what the Haitian peasants say is, behind mountains, more mountains. In other words, once you've dealt with one thing, you're going to find another thing. But I observed the effect of the breakdown of marriage very closely in Britain. For example, in the hospital in which I worked, the illegitimacy rate, what we used to call the illegitimacy rate, you're not allowed to say illegitimacy anymore, but the illegitimacy rate, apart from the children of Indian immigrants, was virtually 100%. And if you asked a child who his father was, sometimes the child would deny that he or she had a father, or alternatively, they would say something like, "Do you mean my father at the moment?" So actually, what happened was that there was serial stepfatherhood, and there were no families; there were households with a kind of varying number of people. The mother being really the center of the household, but she had a succession of partners. And this for children was self-evidently terrible. I mean, it's not that no child could ever negotiate this successfully, but that it was extremely difficult and painful for children. And was bad educationally, was bad psychologically, was bad sociologically. And this, it seemed to me, was so perfectly obvious that it hardly needed research to show it. One just saw it over and over and over again. So if the experiment in Hungary is successful, I wish it all success. I'm pessimistic that it will spread to other countries, because I don't think it's possible anymore. One of the depressing things about conservatism in Britain, and I think in many the prospects for conservatism, is that there is no constituency for it. People are not even aware of what they have lost. One of the great advantages of the communist experience for Hungary is that people know what real suffering and what disaster is, but we don't.
A sober diagnosis from an experienced physician. Thank you very much, Dr. Daniels, for your
thank you
conversation.
Very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this MCC podcast episode. For further media content, please look up our English website at mcc.hu/en. Or look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you want to read more by our professors, external contributors, and students, check out our knowledge base at korvinek.hu/en.